OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that bald spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Okay, so we are in lockdown, as everybody knows at this stage. There is no live sport. That said, we want to take a jaunt down memory lane, and we're looking forward to doing this. We have Richard Cooper. Richard, I'm told this came about really in that our tireless producer, JP, was talking to you. You obviously have done various bits on the show. Some good, some bad, I might add. But you've done various bits on the show.
Some guy I was doing with loads of hair and glasses.
Yeah, just didn't work. Didn't work for me. And you mentioned to JP that you were, I didn't know this about you, you were, and I suppose are, an avid snooker fan. So we thought, well, let's have a chat about your relationship with snooker. And we have drafted in some snooker royalty as well. So hello to you and hello to world champion. Thank you very much. Ken Doherty, how you doing, Ken?
Joe, very good. Thank you. Hi, Richard. How are you?
How are you, Ken? Pleasure to be in the same chat as you, Ken.
Must have been only a week ago, was it? When we were walking the dogs together down in the park, and we were having a little, funny enough, we were having a little chat about snooker memories as well, weren't we? And,
that's right, because the Crucible would have been on at that time. Yeah. And I remember saying that to you, you must feel a bit lost.
Yeah.
Had it been on. And we were talking about the matches that the BBC were showing. They were showing 2 hours of edited highlights, weren't they, of classic matches?
Yeah.
Mm. I think you were involved maybe in a couple that they showed.
Yeah.
And but I was saying, actually, I was wondering, I was asking you why they didn't have Higgins and White semi-final in 1982.
Semi-final, I know, yeah. It was one of the classics, wasn't it? You know, and particularly
particularly
that break in the penultimate frame, you know, to level at 15 all back against the wall. Higgins, 69 break from when he was 55 or 6 behind, like one of the best breaks ever at the World Championship. And
he kept on running
very surprised he didn't. Very surprised that they didn't show that particular match.
Yeah. But it was, I was as well probably just as amazed or as kind of enthused about the commentary
at
that time. And the Jack Carnham, and I think he was a coach, wasn't he? And more.
He was a coach, yeah, he was.
And John Spencer, who had won it in the 70s a good few times, I think. But I remember John Spencer saying it was a brilliant comment, actually, live. And I think it was pretty spontaneous, as Higgins was lining up yet another, like, impossible shot. And it was a blue in the middle of the table. And he had to screw back off the side cushion, you know, to come back for the reds. And it was a mad, like, attempt.
Yeah.
But, of course, John Spencer says, "I'm nervous for him, Jack." I think if he completes this, it will be the greatest break of the two.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was just lovely little moments like that. And, But win it, he did. And it really was. It was, like, your heart.
Yeah, it was incredible, yeah. I mean, that year for me, that was the year sort of I got really hooked on snooker, you know, when Higgins won that in 82. And then, of course, Dennis Taylor won it in 85, you know. But, you know, you go back to commentary, and we were talking, Joe, only in the park, and we were talking about the great Ted Lowe. He was one of our greatest commentators, you know, and they used to call him Whispering Ted Lowe as well. And I never knew why they call him Whispering Ted Lowe, but apparently he used to initially commentate for the radio, and he'd have to sit right up close to the table. So that's where he got the whispers from, you know, when he was commentating live on the radio, before even TV started showing, like, live pictures of snooker. And but he was, for those of you watching in black and white, the brown is next to the blue. that was one of the all-time classics, you know.
Yeah. There's been many kind of bad comments since. But there was one brilliant comment, and I watched the recent coverage between was Joe Johnson, Steve Davis in 86, and Johnson, and And Joe, when he was lining up his shot, Joe Johnson, when he was lining up the shot, the eyebrows would be, you know, and it was a long, particularly if it was a long distance, like, you know, length of the table, red or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
His eyebrows would be going like that. And Ted Lowe said, I think he applauded that shot with his eyebrows. Striking it.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I remember, there's so many of them, you know, and I remember Dennis Taylor telling me one about Fred Davis. When Fred Davis was playing, and he got to the semi-finals of the World Championship, Fred, when he was 65 years of age, you know, and he was one of those players initially that we didn't see very often, but you could play left-handed or right-handed, and if he was stretching over the table, he couldn't reach it right-handed, so he slipped his leg back down on the table, onto the floor, and then played it left-handed, you know. And Ted Lowe famously said, BBC grandstand, well, Fred Davis, all of 65 years, finding it now hard to get the leg over, and now prefers to use his left hand instead. live on BBC grandstand, you know.
Yeah. Carry on up the crucible.
Yeah.
If we're talking about era, can I be so rude as to ask, what are your respective ages?
I'm 51 September.
52.
God. Yeah.
Why aren't you aging, Ken? What's the story there, genuinely?
Well, thanks a million, Joe.
Oh, I don't know. I tell you, I'm aging on the inside, Joe. I don't know about the outside, certainly on the inside, that's for okay. sure.
So you both came to this at obviously basically the same age. So is it Higgins for you, Richard? Is that the lightning bolt moment?
I think so. I think it was also, like I remember watching the you know, when one person is dominant in a sport like Davis was, you want somebody, I suppose, to break it up. And even though, like, Davis is only starting his dominance in the 80s, that 82 match between Higgins and White was, I just thought, like, Higgins, his style alone, and the fact that he didn't have to wear a dicky bow, he got special dispensation not to wear a dicky bow because it caused a rash. Like, he actually had a doctor's cert, which he had to show to the PBSA, the World Billiard Snooker Association, whatever it's called. And but it was almost like, I kind of referred to this in an article, but it was almost like there was a kind of a, like, he was strangulated by the dicky bow, but he was also by the Billiards Association, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
I would just
leave me alone.
The conformity of it. Mm. And it was, there was things that he used to do, apart from kind of walking around the table like he was one of those Olympic race walkers and lashing back the vodkas and tonics and, like, basically sucking the filter out of the end. He was just this swashbuckling character. He'd come on wearing a big hat.
Yeah, big fedora,
fedora, exactly. And, you know, then he'd take off the dicky belt and it'd be all...
twitchy, like
sniffing and nervy and, so you have the open-neck shirt. But he just, I just thought, who is this? Like, he was movie star in the middle of all this. Mm. And then he was just pulling shots out of the bag. You'd never seen, because it was a pretty conservative sport, Ken, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was pretty, it would have been, I mean, it was very sort of gentlemanly and very quiet, you know what I mean? But when Higgins came on the scene, he sort of, it was like opening a can of worms, and it attracted, you know, so many like you and I and a lot of our generation to the game, and would have made like snooker back in the 80s as big as it was because of, on his own, himself, you know what I mean? Because of the character and the electricity. And he was one of those players. And I remember when I was an usher in Goff's and I met him for the first time, when he was sitting in his chair, he had electricity. People would watch him in his chair rather than watch the other guy at the time, because he didn't know what he was going to do. He was twitching all the time, and he was just, he had the electricity around him was just incredible, you know, incredible.
Yeah. How good was he, Ken?
He was brilliant. I mean, I played him, I didn't play him at his best, but I played him when I turned pro in the early 1990, I turned pro, but I played him, I think, that year, 1990-91. And he beat me actually in the UK Championships one year. He beat me 6-3 or 6-4, but played really well. But he was really good. I saw him, I think his best years were behind him when I was a pro. But when he beat Hendry down in Goff's when he was 5-1 down, he beat him in the final, came back to beat him 9-8. It was one of the the greatest finals down there. And that was when he was on his way out. And Hendry was at the top. So he was still an excellent player, an excellent match player. Got a great, even though he was such a great putter, he had such a great safety brain as well, you know. And the thing about Higgins, you were so nervous playing him. He had that because he had that aura about him. And even when he wasn't playing at his best, he could still put you off like your own game, you know, that type of way. But he was one story about Dennis Taylor. He told me when he was playing Higgins, it was a time not long after. I remember Higgins said he'd have him shot the next time he was in Belfast. And Taylor was playing him in Goffs. And Dennis Taylor was introduced fourth. And when you're introduced fourth, you're normally the second seed. So you're the lower seed. You're supposed to sit at the green side of the table, you know, the green pocket. But Dennis Taylor, in all the anxiety and the pressure, he went to the yellow side of the table, sat down and poured himself what he thought was from a jug of ice water, you know. when he tasted the straight vodka, he knew he was on the wrong side of the table. Yeah. Straight vodka,
I think it was the whole package with Alex Higgins, and obviously he was known as the people's champion and all that. And I think some of it was because he fell apart sometimes, didn't he? As well,
You
know. Like, and sometimes when the safety bout was too much, he'd just lash out. You'd seen him kind of at both ends where, you know, both ends of the spectrum where he was just, he couldn't miss and he was unbelievable and spontaneous. And then also the other side, which was just, oh, screw this, I can't be bothered. Well, it wasn't bothered. It was just frustration got the better of him.
He was a great character.
And so, Richard, in the midst of all this, you get a little 6x3 in and you start playing the game.
I was saying this as well before. Like, I had this before I even got to 6x3. Like, what was the spur for my ma to get me a 6x3 was we had this little dinner table in the telly room basically, and it had sort of soft edged corners. You know, there wasn't really kind of hard edged corners because I suppose we were all kids. But I was so obsessed one year with the cruise, but I think it was probably that same year that I got 6 polystyrene cups and sellotaped them to the corner and the middle of the table. I painted table tennis balls, red, white, and black, I think it was, about 4 or 5 table tennis balls, and made a queue out of, there's a bit of tubing that my dad had for something or other, and put a pawn, a snooker piece from a pawn, up the felt end out.
That was my cue.
So I think when Ma saw that, she said, okay, right, either he is a problem or something. But either way, I think we need to get him a snooker table.
It was the best
present. I couldn't actually believe that I was 6x3.
I remember when I saw Higgins, the first time I saw Higgins was actually in Pot Black, and I think it was only about 8 or 9. So it was around 77, 78. And that year, I got a small little table about this size. It was at the end of my bunk bed from Santa, you know? Yeah. And we used to put that on the dinner table. And we'd have, or put it on the floor. And it'd be little, like, sort of marble balls and small little cues this size. And eventually, the rubber on the rails, you know, that were supposed to be there for cushions, they eventually went. They sort of withered away, you know. So once you hit the rail, the ball would just fly down the rail and into the bucket. You know? It'd stick to it like glue.
Yeah.
But then a few years later, when I think it was about 11, I got a 6x3, and we used to sometimes erect it in the living room. And then when the sun came out, we'd have it up in the back garden. And they were my memories. From my father, because my father would watch it. He was a big Ray Reardon fan, so I'd watch it with him, and then he'd watch me play out on the little 6x3 out in the garden or in the front room sometimes. You know,
how quickly did you sort of improve? Kind of, like, I mean, like, when did you make your? Do you remember, like, geez, I just made a 50 break there, or?
Yeah, I think I was. I think that year I was about 13 when I made my first 50, and then I was 14 when I made my first century. You know, so
is that on the 6x3 or the full size?
Oh no, in Jason's on the full size.
Okay.
Yeah. So and I won my first national tournament was in September 1983. And it was the Irish under 16 championship. And I ended up winning that out in Noel Diamond's place out in Finglas, in the classic in Finglas.
The classic
in Finglas. And it's still there, believe it or not. It's one of the few snooker clubs that's still actually open. But in 1983, that was my very first tournament, national tournament, boys under 16, and I won it. And I still have the trophy today. My mother kept that trophy, and we dug it out. It's down in the Radisson now in the snooker room, you know.
So was that what made you kind of think, okay, I'm going to do this now for a living?
Well, I just that kept playing. I mean, I just loved it, you know. Loved watching it, loved playing it. I kept playing football right up until I was about 16 and thought, I know, I can earn some money at snooker. I'm not going to earn any money at football because we used to have little snooker handicap tournaments every Saturday in Jason's. And more often than not, I'd pick up the winners checking that. You know, five are in. You know, there might be about 20 runners and there might be £30 or £40 for the winner, you know. And that was great pocket money those days.
Yeah.
And it was much better than going out to Bushy Park and the lashings of rain during the winter time, you know. So that was the end of the football career, and then I just said I was just going to stick to the snooker, you know.
Yeah. Sorry, Joe. I'm doing your job here, but sorry.
I want to pick both your brains here. You know, so if you mention 1983, Ken, that's why Steve Davies wins that year. He beats Cliff Thorburn.
Yeah.
Thorburn and goes on to dominate. Obviously, Richard, were you looking at Steve Davies full of admiration as well, or was he a Marmite figure, or was he ruining the sport by winning every year? what was the Davies situation for you?
Well, it was kind of begrudging kind of respect. Mm-hmm. Like, it did seem at one stage that he couldn't miss. I mean, I think particularly he won the first in 81, and then he was beat, wasn't he, very early in 82?
Yeah, Tony Knowles.
Tony Knowles beat him 10-1 or something. But then he won it again in 83 and 84. I kind of felt the one thing I always think that I'd give Davies sort of credit for was that he was responsible for some of the best matches in sport, wasn't he? Because he was so brilliant and it was such an incredible achievement to beat him. And when Davies beat him, or sorry, when Taylor beat him in that final, it was just like that really made the sport, didn't it?
Absolutely. And the fact that they had, like, Davies and Higgins had this great rivalry between each other, you know, the good and the bad, like, you know. And
and were you a Higgins man or a Davies man?
I was always a Higgins man, you know. I always say that to Steve, you know what I mean? He wouldn't. I remember there was one quote from Higgins, you know, and a reporter said to Higgins, would you not, you know, go out with Davies, like, see Steve Davies socially? And Higgins turned around, I'd rather have a drink with Edie Amin.
More of a chance of it as well, probably.
But Davies actually, even though he never got on with Higgins, they were sort of chalk and cheese. But I think as he grew older, he had more of a respect for him and sort of. I remember him doing the documentary there on the BBC, and some of the matches, and Higgins was one of them. And he started crying. He started filling up because he was interviewing Higgins' daughter. And he started filling up. He said he misses Alex Higgins now, like, you know, in some of the great games. He didn't appreciate it then, but as he got a bit older, he started to appreciate it. But they started that great rivalry that everybody loved to see the two of them play each other. It was just fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, and also the sport, probably, even though it didn't fully embrace Higgins, didn't embrace him at all, really. It really needed him, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, he drew crowds everywhere he went, you know. I mean, and when you played him, the atmosphere was like no other atmosphere against any other player. And players used to love or hate playing him because of it. I must say, any time I played him, I absolutely loved it. The only time I didn't like playing him was when I played him at the World Championship, and it was the last time he ever played there, and I beat him 10, I think it was 10-6. We played the very first round of the Crucible.
What year was that?
I think it was 1994.
Yeah,
and he never played another match. And during the match, he had a big flare up with John Williams, the referee, which I knew was going to happen at some stage. But John Williams was quite a forthright, very strong referee, you know. And Higgins was at the table. Now I think it was about 8-4 up at one stage, and then he started to implode a little bit. And he said to John Williams, John Williams was standing on his right-hand side, and he just went like that, as if to say, get over, did it to my left-hand side. And John Williams says, no, Alex, I've been staying here all day. You can't see me. I'm not in your line of sight, he goes. You're not in my line of sight, John. You're in my line of thought. You know, just anything yeah. to spark around, you know. But he was fantastic. But that was the last, that was the only match I think I never really enjoyed playing to beat him, and it was his last appearance. And but he was good as gold to me, you know. We were good, we became really sort of good friends in a way after that, you know, which was quite nice, you know.
Yeah.
Is Taylor's win in 85, is that the high point, Richard?
I think it probably was. I'd certainly, for, you know, obviously having not played us to any great level, that was to me, just from a television perspective, the pinnacle. And it seemed like from then on, I thought, like, I loved watching Ken play. I loved watching Ken winning it, obviously, as well in 97. But I thought the Hendry era wasn't as exciting, you know, maybe because he was just so dominant. Even though Davis had been dominant in the 80s, I just thought there was more drama, more excitement. And I know it's a bit of a cliche to say there were more characters, because it's a bit of a rose-tinted perception. But I do think there's a bit of truth in that as well, that Hendry was almost like too good. And even though you beat him, that year in 97, Ken. Yeah. That must have been, I mean, for you going into that, that must have been, did you feel like, yeah, I'm actually going to...
No, not at all. I mean, I had a terrible run up to that year. And I had to win my first round match to stay in the top 16. So that was like, that was the huge match for me. And because, you know, the run up to it, I'd lost in three first rounds, two to Davis, Steve Davis, and then one to Michael Judge, fellow countryman in the British Open. So I had a terrible run in. I wasn't playing that well. And I remember in the run, the couple of weeks before, practicing in Ilford and Essex, Sullivan and I never really practiced that much with each other. But we said, look, we sort of put our little differences aside, and we said, look, let's practice together every day for the couple of weeks before the World Championship. And we got into a sort of a mode, playing each other like two best of 19 sometimes each day, or one best of 19, whatever the case may have been. And we both went to the World Championship. He was absolutely flying, and he made that 147 that year in 5 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yeah.
And my main concern was winning that first match against Mark Davis to stay in the top 16. And once I did that, it was sort of like a weight lifted off me, and I beat Steve Davis in the next round. I beat him 13-3, and then I beat Higgins in the quarterfinals, Robbie Dill, and going into the final, I thought I had a chance against Hendry, but he was going for like 6 in a row, like 30 matches in a row, which was quite. So I was a big underdog. But what kept me going was the images of Higgins and Taylor lifting the cup. You know those images where they're lifting the cup up, and they're lifting it up to the crowd, and the spotted lights in the ceiling and stuff like that. And I could see myself doing that for some reason. I used to dream about it, like during that World Championship. And I could visually see myself lifting the cup. This was before the final or anything. And that sort of kept me very relaxed. And it was like, you know, the powers, people talk about the powers of visualization. That's what it was like for me. I could see myself lifting the cup, and it sort of calmed me. You know, I wasn't as nervous as I probably should have been against Stephen Hendry going into that final. And I just played as well as I've ever played, and couldn't have played much better, and beaten like 18-12 in the end, which was quite a marginal victory, you know.
That's amazing. Did you have that type of visualization in future tournaments?
Sometimes it used to come and go, but you know what they always say, if you could bottle that, you know, you know. But most sports people would say to you, you know, that they've seen it, you know, they've seen it before it actually happened. And for me, yeah, I definitely did, you know. But I wish I could have done it a lot more times over the years. I know that. You know, when the yell gremlins get into your head,
scar
you
tissue.
Can't see anything. Oh, yeah.
See, for me, I have such a different perspective and all that, because I was in first year secondary school when you won in 97. So I hadn't seen the 80s.
Yeah.
And for me, I just seemed to be this boring sort, hands up. Like the Michael Schumachers, the Roger Federers, whoever's dominant, I like seeing history unfold. So
I loved
Stephen Hendry. I loved watching him beat Jimmy White. I'm the only kid in class who loved watching Stephen Hendry beat Jimmy White. But geez, when you beat him, it's hard to overstate just how awesome he was. He was going for six in a row, I think, that year.
Six in a row, 30 matches in a row, which was quite incredible, you know.
And he won most of his finals pretty easily, didn't he?
Like
he did.
I mean, the closest one was apart from White, 18-17. Yeah, when Jimmy had that black, but the rest of them were very, you know, convincing wins. Like, he was such a great player, Hendry. He revolutionized the sport completely, you know, when he came on the scene compared to the way the game was played in the 80s. He would have been a huge inspiration for the likes of O'Sullivan, the likes of Higgins, and the likes of Mark Williams in those days. And he would have inspired even the guys that are at the top of the game now, the likes of the Judd Trumps, the likes of the Neil Robertson. They would have watched Hendry over the years, even though they were quite young. But they would have played the likes of him and the way sort of Ronnie O'Sullivan brought it on again to another level.
Sorry to interrupt, Ken. In what aspect of the game did he change? How was it different to the 80s?
Hendry's philosophy was that when he was at the table, he was going to try and win the frame from one position, you know? He didn't want his opponent back at the table. So it was all out attack, you know? Put a long red, split the pack, and score and make enough to win the frame and sit down and get the next frame on the board. Where the 80s was a little bit more of a cautious type style. The way even they broke the balls, they'd go into the side of the pack and they'd take one or two reds out at a time. Whereas Hendry came with the philosophy, get on the blue, hit the pink full ball, open as many balls as possible and make the break as easy as possible for yourself. So that's exactly how he became such a prolific break builder.
Right. That's snooker as I know it.
Of
course you go into the pack off the blue. That's just what you
do. Yeah, exactly. That's because you're used to seeing it now. But when you watch the guys back in the 80s, you would see like they'd be knocking reds off blacks, but off the corner of the pack, you know, bringing one or two out, and then they get on the black and then do it on the other side and bring one or two. And that's how they develop reds.
Whereas it's more risk averse.
Yeah. And if they got a 40 or 50 break, you know, they'd put a red safe, put a yellow safe or a colour safe, and then they'd try and win it on their second visit. Whereas Hendry was a one visit. He was a one visit man, like, you know.
His positional play as well was a joy to behold, in fairness. Mm.
But were you sitting there, Richard, with your arms crossed saying, I'm not enjoying this as much as I used to?
I probably was. I've kind of felt that way about, like, other sports as well, of like Sampras. When Sampras was dominant, I actually thought Sampras was a really boring player, though, really boring tennis player. Particularly Wimbledon, you know, just big serve and volley, that's it.
Yeah.
He was absolutely dominant as well. So I think apart from Borg, who you know who I'm talking about, Joe, even if you didn't witness him, you know, don't rub it in, whatever you do. I was always up for him. Like, I was always up for him, like McEnroe and Connors and the Stads, you know, all those. But no, I've usually wanted whoever's dominant.
Richard, would you not have been like of the Jimmy White ilk? You would not want Jimmy to win against Hendry most of the time.
I wanted Jimmy to win because it's because also, I mean, you know, that semi final that he lost to Higgins in 82. Yeah. Arguably would have been, you know, possibly his best chance to win the thing. And if he had won that, God knows.
My memory
of that as well was that he had a perm.
He had
a perm and the teeth. He hadn't been to the dentist, obviously.
No.
The buck teeth were way out. And he was kind of emotion-free as well. There was nothing seemed to register on his face. It was just... He just took it on the chin and
He always says, you know, Jimmy White, well, anytime, you know, regrets around like that. And I said, like, you know, you think about that 82 semi-final, if you had won that, you would have won the world championship. He says, yeah, mate. He says, I would have won the world championship if I had B. Higgins, but I'd probably be dead by now.
What about as we moved into 21st century then? Did it recapture your heart, Richard?
Well, a little bit. You have to, you know, take your hat off to Ronnie, and he's an amazing player. And yeah, that 147 that Ken is talking about, like, I suppose he is a bit of everything, hasn't he? He's a bit of, you know, his safety play is also brilliant.
Yeah.
He has that magic. He's like, his 147 was like, you know, like somebody popping balls with a wand. It was incredible what he's able to do. But he's also has the ability to fly off the handle. Mm. And you think, like, just when he's acting normally, when he's kind of doesn't seem to be registering, you know, he's sort of, everything's fine. Everything's actually fine. He feels sure he's going to actually explode. I mean, it's as close as it ever came to an actual, you know, fisticuffs in the Crucible, to my knowledge anyway, was myself and Ali Carter. Ali Carter wouldn't get out of his way. I can't even remember what happened, but it was like, that was the biggest news of the Crucible.
Yeah, they gave each other a little shoulder charge, didn't they, when they walked by each other. It was quite funny.
I think it has got a bit more more interesting again. It's obviously it's not going to ever do it for me in the same way as the 80s, but Trump coming along is good. Judd Trump coming along, he's come along at a pretty good time as well, hasn't he?
And
he's kind of stepped it up a gear, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. Yeah, I love the way he plays.
I mean, he's really improved again.
I think he's brought a wonderful freshness to the game, you know. And his range of shots are like the Jimmy White of yesteryear. You know, he expresses himself, and even though he's not, you know, facially sort of interactive with the crowd, or you don't get much emotion out of him, but his array of shots and talent is just incredible to watch. So he's brought a new sort of freshness to the game completely. So it's good.
Yeah.
So if you go kind of Joe Davis with his 15 titles and this Fred, and of the modern era, there's Hendry with 7, Steve Davis 6, Ronnie with 5. You know, in golf, there's this like bit of verbal gymnastics where they say, who's the greatest? And increasingly what everyone says now when they're asked is, well, Jack Nicklaus with his 18 majors is the greatest champion, but Tiger Woods has played the greatest golf we've ever seen. I wonder, is there a similar thread in there with snooker, or is there an acknowledgement is the best?
No, I think, I mean, Hendry, for me, the world championship, because he dominated it for so long, with 7 in 10 years, I think he won. I mean, his last win was in 99 when he was only 31 years of age, I think, you know. So, would he have been 30? I'm trying to think. Yeah, he won it in 99. He was January 69 when he was born. So he's only 31 in 6 months when he won his last world title, which is very, very young considering, you know, Sullivan's still going now when he's in his mid-40s. But I think it's very hard to compare, but I would say, you know, O'Sullivan has probably played the best snooker that we've ever seen. There's no doubt about that. I don't think anybody. But Hendry in a matchup to O'Sullivan in the World Championship, I don't know. I think it's a pretty even match.
Yeah, it's probably like the difference between match snooker and talent, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like you'd probably say O'Sullivan is the most talented player. Certainly he's the most talented player I've ever seen, but Hendry is probably just better at winning matches.
Yeah. It'd be like you and me playing snooker, Richard. You'd have all the talent, but I'd be the match player.
Yeah, I'd be using everything I can to put you off. That's the only talent I'd have on that snooker.
What happened to Hendry, Ken?
He just retired. He retired very young. Apparently, I didn't know this at the time, but apparently he started to get a bit of the yips. And he retired, I think, in 06. But he sort of, I think he had enough. He got a contract to promote Chinese pool in China and to go over there for a week every month. And he thought, well, this is a good way out. I'll take that. And it's now a good time to get out of snooker because he got the yips. And when you get the yips, Joe, at any sport, it's one of the most horrible things that can happen to any sportsman. So it was probably a good time for him to get out.
Did you ever get them?
No, and Jesus, I hope I never do.
Don't even say the word.
No, no. I get them at golf now and again, or I might get them at tennis playing Richtern, but I haven't got them at snooker just yet, you know.
I presume I don't really know what the yips are, other than I can imagine what they are. But I presume I've heard about them in darts where you can't.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. So when you're on your backswing, when you're on your backswing, you start jabbing, you know, instead of just playing like that. So you don't know when to hit it, like, you know. So it must be a horrible feeling, you know.
In golf, they describe it as like an electric shock.
Yeah.
At the moment, you're meant to go from backswing to.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh no, it's a horrible
thing.
Take
up something else, didn't you?
Yeah.
It's something else for a living.
You got back to the polystyrene cups at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was a good thing there.
So yeah, you both had your little 6x3s, and both would have started playing around the same time. I'm curious to see when your paths diverged. Richard, what was your highest break?
83 was my highest break.
Oh, very
that's
good.
Yeah, that was on a full size. But that's it's funny because that was when I was a good bit older, and I was in my 20s, I'd say. Maybe about 20, and I would have been 20, and it was actually against a theatre director, and he's actually never given me a job since. But yeah, I beat the lard out of him. I was just playing really well. I don't know why. Yeah. And I hadn't played for a while. I just made a break of it, mainly around the blue. And actually, I should have got a century, but I'm not sure I got the yips or
And do you ever get a chance to play now at all on your travels or anything?
Every now and again, I've played in your place a couple of times. Thanks
have you?
For the plug there, Ken.
Yeah.
I would have played a couple of times, and not very often, but in the winter, like it's a bit of a winter sport, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah.
I have the World Championships in end of July. Is that right, sir?
This year, yeah, we'll have the World Championships the end of July. They have that window where the Olympics was supposed to be. So if it goes ahead, fingers crossed, like, you know, I don't know what's going to happen between now and then. But hopefully it will still go ahead. Whether it'll have a crowd or whether it'll be behind closed doors, we don't know. But hopefully it will still go ahead. But you're right, yeah. I mean, the snooker season really sort of kicks off around September, October time, and then runs till the bank holiday in May.
Yeah. I probably would have got a higher break, Joe, only for the fact that I started getting interested in acting. So instead of getting the cue out, I was getting my tights out and the wigs and practicing the Shakespeare monologues. So that was the end of me. The end of my career right there.
Yeah.
What could have been. Ken, the last one, what's the talent like coming through? That year when I'm watching you win, I mean, me and all my mates are down the snooker club. It's just what you did
in your teenage years
after school. I've no idea. I don't have kids. If that still happens, is there a lot of talent coming through?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, a lot of the snooker clubs, even when you were going to the snooker clubs, a lot of those have closed down. So there's not many opportunities for young kids to go and play unless their fathers are bringing them or stuff like that. You don't see a lot of sort of... And the problems are because of these phones that we're messing around with here, you know, and Fortnite and computer games, Minecraft. A lot of people are, you know, a lot of kids are starting them too young, and they're not like delving into sports at an earlier age. So I fear for snooker, particularly here. I mean, across the world, it's getting bigger, in China particularly, and around the world, it's getting a lot, and in Europe, it's getting a lot bigger. But I'd like to see a lot more here. But we do have one professional who's going to be coming on the tour next year, and he's from Cork, a guy called Aaron Hill. He's the European under 18 champion and European under 21 champion. So he's got his pro ticket to start the new season in September.
Okay. Well, we won't put pressure on him, but there's nothing like Irish involvement to get the bandwagon up and going again.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, you need somebody to keep flying the flag. You know, there's no doubt about that.
Okay. So listen, fellas, that was great. A nice walk down memory lane. I didn't know Richard Cooper was bunking off school to watch snooker back in the day. I just can't believe this.
There was one day, actually, myself and a pal of mine, a fella called Fred Cronin, we were walking along and we had arranged to bunk off, and we were getting the dart out to Dunleary was the idea.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know what we were going to do, really. But so we found a crisp £20 note before the days of Euros, £20 note. right there adjacent to the dark tracks.
Oh, happy days.
So I thought this is a sign that we should be playing snooker all day. but the idea of like I think I was 13, so what constituted a treat in those days was, and how to spend your 20 quid in the best way, was playing snooker all day, and we went to McDonald's twice. That was them were the days.
Those were the days, yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. You can't beat them.
Well, McDonald's is about to reopen, so we can look forward to the queues very soon.
Yeah.
Richard Cooper, Ken Doherty, fellas, that was great. Thanks a mil.
Pleasure. Thanks, Joe.